Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Mojan. Hey, thank you for joining.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I'm glad everybody's here to listen. I asked Kirk the other day, I was recording with him, and he mentioned that he listens to episodes. And I said, do you listen to the intro or do you just skip ahead? And there was this long pause and he was trying to figure out what the right answer was, I think. Because like, it's okay if you skip ahead.
Why? Yeah, it's okay to skip ahead. It does not require thinking. No. If it was me, I would say whatever I do. I mean, sometimes with different podcasts, I skip ahead. I don't know.
Yeah, and some podcasts have like the little hook up front. They had taken excerpt out. I tried that once. Mm-hmm. And it's a pain. There might be three or four things that are like perfect little clips. Yet it's, you have to find it, isolate it, pull it up front, you know, and it's because we're doing the edits ourselves. So it's, it's a pain.
Yeah.
So I got a question for you. It came out of the last episode we were chatting, and you might remember it, you know, but we were chatting about what's in it for them. And one of the topics that came up that sparked an interest for me to talk about with you is how do you leave a team so that they can continue to improve with you not there?
Ooh, I love that. That's a great question.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that you mentioned, yeah, I'm getting a text. You done over there? They miss you and your bright personality and witty intellect and all the skills that you have. But in reliability and in quality to some extent, I've always heard this phrase is that you work until you're not needed anymore. And mm-hmm. I've always translated that as that our role is to, we bring in expertise, but we also put in processes and systems and ways of thinking through problems that the team we're working with can do on their own and can teach new people that process and keep it alive within their organization. It's really where I see it the most is in the more mature reliability programs where they're very proactive and they regularly benefit because of the work they do to avoid problems and make things work smoothly and create really good designs consistently and stuff like that. The entire team recognizes the value of what they're doing and then keeps it alive by that's the way we do things here. So somebody else comes on, this is why we do what we do. They understand it well enough that they can do it. Yet it's not getting that project done. It's not getting this design out. It's not, you know, troubleshooting failures in the field and sorting those things out. It's not predicting warranty. It's not any of the tools that we have that we apply in a reliability plan, for example. So it's a different problem, yet I think it's one even as consultants that, and think of it as a reliability engineer on a program is really a consultant. They need to mm-hmm. behave and act like a consultant. They might not get paid as much, but they also get insurance and, you know, benefits and other stuff. So yeah. That adds up, mm-hmm. as I know when I didn't have them anywhere.
Yes.
But the idea is, you know, have you ever thought about that? How do you leave your team in a better spot than where they were before?
I think that's it. Yeah, it's such a good point. I was thinking when you first mentioned the question, I was thinking about like literally what did I do? Like what during my last like 2 weeks, what was I doing? And I think that's part of it. But I think to your other point is in general, what I realized as you were describing this was what I was always trying to do. Yeah, even before I knew like and you know, years from before when I knew when I was gonna leave, was trying to make myself redundant. Mm-hmm. Like I think every reliability engineer ideally should be trying to make themselves redundant. Like the whole, whether you're even obviously, of course, also as a consultant, but also when you're full time, for sure. Like, you know, you should be trying to make yourself redundant. Now, in my case, I was trying to make myself redundant in part based for what you said in that, like, hey, this is like kind of the placing in the methods and teaching the methods and such to everybody such that they just become the muscle memory for everybody and everyone sees the benefits and it's just happening anyway.
Right.
But also in part to, of course, like, you know, replace myself as a manager to allow the other engineers to grow and, you know, enable them to take on more responsibilities and learn more and, you know, try different things. And same for myself, you know, to for me to go and do something else, which is what happened. So, yeah, I think it's that's ideally that's what everybody would be doing, making themselves redundant.
Well, it's for me, it was, you know, I don't want to do the tedious stuff. You know, and I don't need to decide what we need to test or what we need to do a derating on or things like that. I shouldn't have to be checking all of this stuff. This isn't the electrical engineer's job. This is a mechanical engineer's job. This is somebody else's job.
Yes.
Design needs to be embedded in the organization, not in me. And I've seen it happen where an engineer, a reliability engineer, did everything. Actually worked with the electrical engineers to say, all right, you're going to select this component. I recommend this rated one for that deal. He did the derating calculations or estimates and stuff and on and on and on. And when he walked out the door, because he was burnt out, the entire program left. Nobody knew how to do any of this stuff because he would just do it. And that's a disservice to that team, I think, in that regard. But mostly it's because I'd rather, you know, give me the really cool, interesting problem that needs a really creative, accelerated life test. I want to go figure that one out. And it takes time to do that. And I can't be doing that if I'm running FMEAs all day long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I think the responsibilities of the DFRs, it's interesting when you say that. I felt exactly the same about failure analysis. When I was doing failure analysis, after a while, I was like, you know what? Like, I don't know if I want to be in the lab as much. Like, give me the interesting problems, and I will say what analysis we need to do. And I don't need to be looking at every screw that is, you know, fatiguing. At some point, I had so many pins and bolts and screws. I was like, okay, I don't even need to look at it. I can tell what happened. But of course, I'm exaggerating. But yeah,
no, I get that. But it's one of those where it's, you know, how about we move this to, we prevent these problems and then let's work on that. And then once we are able to prevent those problems, how do we make this systemic? How do we make it so embedded and visible and valuable that it just sustains itself? And then I can just kind of touch it along and the ball keeps rolling kind of thing versus trying to get this large mass moving. And it takes time. And we talked about it in our last episode, how do you make change? Yet I think the goal of that is so that we could leave and the changes will still go on. The benefits will still be there. The program will self-propagate that, we do DFR because it's useful. And, you know, I think we missed that in the last episode, is that the reason we're doing that is that, it's good for the engineers. It's good for the customers. It's good for the schedule. It's good for all kinds of reasons. Yet at the end of the day, it just makes a bit of space so that your team can focus on what's important, is get it right and add the, so, you know, it's no trade-offs on, we got 10 features and we have time to do it. Then, it, you know, somebody will come along saying, well, you made that look too easy. We're going to cut the next design cycle by 6 months. There's always that person in the room. We got to fix that.
Yeah, you're right. I think ultimately, you know, like it's useful in helping build a better product, and that is the purpose that reliability is serving, and therefore the best way to do that is to make it such that it's systemic, like you said, and that it's not reliant on one person or one team necessarily to enable that. So, I mean, from a practical standpoint, of course, like some things you may need, like, you know, like a skill set for, like, I don't know. But ideally, yes, it should be in such a way that it's just built in and it doesn't need one person that is doing everything.
I think there is a medical drama / comedy show where it was this crotchety old doc that was basically did the really bizarre you know, mystery solving. It's like a detective story almost. I had to figure out, why is this person having these symptoms? And then we'd figure it out at the last minute. Of course, it was a scripted 1 hour show. Mm-hmm. I'd rather be the one called in when it's important, you know, and nobody else knows how to do it. It's that's more fun than, you know, all the other stuff. But you can't get to that unless you clear the decks and everybody else understands they have a role in this too. And that kind of stuff. But and although I do remember one time is I got called down to the shipping dock and there was a pallet that was looked like it was ready to be shipped. And I said, why are you showing me this? And he said, this was a return. So this hit our warranty this month. Like, oh, doesn't even look like it was unwrapped. Or no, they said, no, this is our wrapping by our robot that does it for us. And it's stacked by our robot. Humans don't stack it that way. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I had, you know, it was one of those things where, all right, well, this hit warranty. This is costing us money. Has nothing to do with the design. Now what do I do? It's like, so I went and found, embarrassed somebody in the finance department that was just, you know, oh, this came in, we'll charge that, do that. And this goes to that department. And they were just paper pushing it. And I said, doesn't it seem odd that you get a whole perfect pallet back? The number of items is a pallet. And he goes, oh, yeah, I know that. I saw that. And that didn't spark any interest in you to ask a question or check it out. This is worth like $800,000. Oh, no, it just did numbers to me. Like, all right. let me take you on a walk through the production line. We had a small production facility in the building, which was beautiful because our design teams are right there. And we had, and it wasn't the bulk of our production. That was all over the world, but we had a line there. And we walked the line. And I said, see how much work goes into making one of these things? And that pallet over there, because it's warranty, we have to take it apart, unbox them, make sure they all work, put them in a new box and sell them at a discount. And then his eyes lit up and he goes, well, that'll hurt the profit. Yeah. Imagine that.
Know that? They hadn't taken that into account?
Oh, no.
Incredible.
Yeah. And it was not my job description, yet it was the kind of patterns and things that you can see when you have the luxury of a team that's working really well. That you can say in parts of your team then say, hey, why is this happening? That's why I got called onto the dock. Part of the team said, this isn't right. And they didn't know how to solve it. So we put our heads together and talked to the right people to change the warranty policy and the restocking policy type stuff. But it only can happen when you have a team that's firing well enough that they pay attention to it. And you can work then on these weird problems that show up in every organization.
Right. Yeah. You need the space to be able to pay attention to the things like that show up.
Yeah. Because otherwise, so even if it's, you know, you're not replacing yourself, you're giving yourself permission to solve problems and instead of doing everything. So I think there's part of it, and part of it might be my selfish self, as I like those kinds of problems versus, you know, turning bolts on nuts on screws and all day long. But sometimes it feels like that for some of us. I ran into a couple of folks that, and this one woman was doing, was brought on board to run some Weibel analysis. They had, I don't know, like 20 or 30 SKUs that they were getting field data back from, and they were every month wanted it updates on that. So part of her job was to analyze the field returns and create these graphics and reports and stuff like that. And she required no training whatsoever. She looked at the first one and it was the first time working in reliability statistics. She had some data analysis statistics background, yet first time in reliability stuff. She did a Weibull plot and she caught something that have you done this before? Have you worked with this? Have you been trained on this stuff? And she goes, no, but this doesn't look right. And then I called these people and I called those folks and I found out it was this, that, and the other thing. And we, you know, made a change in the design or in some other repair process, I think it was. And I thought, that's brilliant. And went right around to the quality managers. You need to give her a pay raise. She's hitting way above what you're paying her now. because she's actually curious about what she's doing and seeing the connections to the business. You know, it's hard to train that. And she walked in doing it. So that was like, so.
That's amazing. Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's, we're all going to leave our organization or our client one way or the other, right? For consulting, it's self-preservation. Is if you do well with a client, they'll probably invite you back and or keep you on, you know, for other more interesting projects and stuff like that. It keeps the revenue stream going. And there's no guarantee of that, yet having happy customers really does help with return business and word of mouth and stuff like that. Within an organization, it allows you the bandwidth to really solve systemic problems that you just don't have time for otherwise. And so it has lots of benefits. Plus, I'd like seeing teams improve and overall they benefit as a good DFR program comes into play, like we were talking about in our last episode. But it's something I think you have to be conscious of. And I know that you build in training routinely. That's part of it. And then it's also that managed by walking around kind of stuff is like, oh yeah, you're doing derating. That's great. This is, you know, how's it working for you? Any trouble with that? It's the on the spot coaching and training. It's the show up at a design review and says, all right, how did the derating go? You know, any issues with that? And you know, stuff like that, that then just sets an example of how to keep it going, how to make it happen. Because it's funny, people do what's measured. And I think that goes to what's observed. If we pay attention when people are doing things right and recognize that or reward it in some way, that really helps a lot to back to the change management stuff. But it also demonstrates that, you know, it's not always somebody saying, oh, you screwed that up, you got to redo it. Us reliability folks now that only us know about the secret is we can be, you know, make change by influence people by being positive and reinforcing good behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much of like, you know, in again, going back to the example that I gave in the, like, I think it was previous episode, where I was saying that it took me a while to build trust with the team that I was working with at one of my jobs. Mm-hmm. Part of what, you know, it kind of was a catalyst of its own. Once I worked with a few engineers in that team, and, you know, they saw the benefit of what I was doing, they communicated to the rest of the team as to like, hey, like, you know, there was this one picture that we took from the part that we looked at, and it was so obvious, like what was going on. It's super beneficial. Like it would just, you know, saved us so much time and, you know, not chasing our tails and, you know, going down rabbit holes to figure out what the issue is. Right. And then that, you know, then it was just, like you say, it was like a positive feedback loop, because then other people just knew, to reach out, and, you know, it just was on their minds. And then similarly with the training, you know, I've had cases where some people that take the training, they're like, that was amazing. Like, let's, you know, and then they tell other people, and then, you know, it starts to become, it feeds itself basically. And so, you know, it can take time, but it can help in that way as well. And you, it just kind of becomes built into the system, and it's systematic between the different teams.
Yeah. Yeah. No, then you know you're on the right track, and you can ask for a pay raise then. It's, you
know. Maybe we should make that one of the topics. It's like, I want to know how you figure out what's the threshold. Is it feedback? I like to say that it's seeing results. Like, I want to see results before I
I think there's something there. It's the short answer, and this is one we should do, is how do you, that might be the topic of it. I'm going to delegate here. I have to practice that. It's a weakness of mine, not delegating enough. Because you're the one that usually shows up and says, oh, here's 3-4 topics, and we're off and flying. And so I know you pay attention to that. But how do you ask for a pay raise as a reliability engineer? the short answer is, if you can pull out those, what I call them value slides, my boss at HP made us do these things. They were, we just howled that, oh, why do we do this? It's obvious that it makes a difference. He goes, how much difference? Get it in their words. So when we worked with a division and solved a problem for them, we always went back and asked, so what difference did this make? And how much money did it save you or prevent or recover or do whatever? And after a year, there were five of us on the team and we had, I don't know, 30 slides that tallied $150 million of profit that was generated by our work. And he said, I know what we're doing is valuable. And we're as valuable as a billion-dollar company, because that's the kind of profit margin that these billion-dollar divisions are creating in this, in our technology. And we're like, there's only five of us. And he goes, exactly. And we very efficient. We solved big problems, you know, we did all, and we tracked it and we got it in the words of the people we were working with. This saved them money. And so we had it documented. So I went in with my five slides and says, so can I get a pay raise based on this? And he says, hell no.
That's it. Yeah, exactly.
But no, that's the short story of it. It actually did do pretty well. And that whole team did pretty well because it was recognized how useful we were. And it is a way to do it. But if you're only walking in there and your boss has a stack of things you screwed up and how much you cost the money and you don't have the counterbalance of how much value you added, it's a short conversation.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. No, I agree with you. I think it's important to talk about like what difference did it make? Another quote that I'd like to use for t-shirts. I'm going to write that down.
No. I know it's possible. I know you know how to do this stuff. It's not hard to do. Can I get a, you know, can I at least contribute to the graphic design or?
Oh, of course.
Review
of course.
It? Okay. Maybe.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. This is going to be, maybe we'll start a merchandise section on your website.
Well, I have one on the No MTBF site. It's through Cafe Press everything there has the No MTBF logo on it. You can even get earrings and coffee mugs. Coffee mugs has been the bestseller. Yeah. And they're all at cost. It's not cheap getting something from them because it's all made to order in the same spot. And the coffee mugs are pretty solid. I've had one for a decade now. There are ways to do it where you just add it to somebody else. It costs a little bit more and it was reasonable quality, but there's lots of ways to go about doing it these days. I haven't looked into options in 10 years plus, so I'm sure there's a way. But anyway, now that we're talking about merchandise and we're talking about value and all kinds of other cool stuff, we should get back to if you're not working to improve the organization so that the benefits and the value of, say, DFR or root cause analysis or whatever it is you're implementing a change on, if it doesn't continue after you leave, did you really help them? You know, do you actually make a change or were you carrying it for them so that when you leave, it goes with you? So as reliability engineers, I think we all need to think about that all the time. Now, if you got a question on this or another idea or an insight for this kind of thing, let me know. Let us know. Give us a comment or a question over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. It's a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Mijan and I and the other hosts of the show are available through LinkedIn and our about pages. So lots of ways you can add value. Let's put that in there by participating and contributing into the show. We really appreciate when you do. So anyway, I think good wrap up there. All right. Thanks so much, Mijan, for letting me spring that on you. And I recognize right at the start, you were like, what in the world's going to happen now?
No, it was very fun. Thank you. Thank you for the great topic.
All right, great. All right, we'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.